So this is Dr. Howard Gerr from the Shrink is In, and today the podcast is a conversation between myself and Dr. Les Posen, who's a clinical psychologist in Australia who specializes in the use of virtual reality exposure therapy for fear of flying. Dr. Posen has been doing this for a long time, so the two of us are going to be talking about our relative experiences with VR and with clinical work, and maybe some touch on what's going to happen in the future. And if this works out, maybe we'll do this again. So this might be episode number one in a series. So without any further delay, here's The Shrink is In. So it's Dr. Howard Gerr from The Shrink is In. And today I'm talking to Dr. Les Posen, who's a psychologist in Australia doing similar work to me in using VR for the mental health, behavioral health field. And I just thought it'd be interesting to kind of talk about this from a perspective of us being on two sides of the earth doing similar things and where we see VR in its trajectory in behavioral health and what the future is going to bring. So Les, welcome to The Shrink is In.
Thanks for that. You know, I have to say that being physically separated by 10,000 miles, given how COVID has accelerated technology that gives us telehealth, you might think, well, we're not really competing for the same population, but I've got to tell you, we are. I have patients in New York. I have patients in San Francisco, and we've been working using telehealth and rather inexpensive VR equipment where they can just put their iPhone or their Samsung into, you know, a $70 headset and using the software that you and I have centered our clinical work on, that's the SAIS from Spain, you know, you and I can control at this end of things and give them a reasonable experience of testing out some of the things that you and I will be educating our patients with. So in some respects, we're not competing at all for the same market, but in another respect, we are.
Yeah, I think the pandemic has made the world very small.
Yes.
And I think that it escalated the idea that, telehealth is actually a reasonable approach to deal with mental health issues. We haven't seen patients here face-to-face since March of 2020.
Same.
Right? So everything is done online. And the fact that SIOS, or really whatever they want to call themselves these days.
Amelia. I think they changed to Amelia.
Yeah, they did change to Amelia. And I think that they've kind of opened up a door to allow us to do what we do remotely.
Yes, I think that was always going to be their plan, that when they made the switch, when they first came in with the Samsung Gear, which you might remember,
right,
which was the forerunner and basically didn't compete with the then tethered Oculus Rift, which you recall, and they were two very different markets. And I think it was always the case that SAIS wanted to go down this portability side of things, where they could do this sort of long distance, you know, telehealth route of doing VR, as compared to the patient has to come to your office to do all the work there and doesn't get a chance then to practice at home using the same equipment.
Also, I think the idea of making it that portable and using phones as the engine, so to speak.
Yeah.
Made it much more plausible for clinicians like ourselves to step into that territory. Because prior to that, you know, I've been following VR for about 25 years now, and I couldn't afford it as a clinician. And clearly the resolution and the equipment was pretty primitive on some levels.
Mm-hmm.
But starting around 2015 or so, that's when this, you know, generational change happened. And I think that should have opened up the doors for a lot of clinicians to step into this territory, but it hasn't.
And, no, we still are confronting the old ideas that this technology comes between me and my patients rather mm-hmm. than augments what I can bring to the therapeutic situation. And I've always thought that if you choose your technologies appropriately, if you introduce it in the most appropriate way, it will always make a good psychologist even better. The big mistake I think that many psychologists have made, and to some extent our technology wizards have been complicit, is the idea that you buy a turnkey system, buy the whole system, learn how to use the settings, and then you become a great VR therapist. And I think you and I have been around for such a long time right. now that we know you can't turn someone who's an average therapist with a minimal understanding of behavioral change mechanisms, let's just say down the CBT route or ACT if you want to go down that way, the equipment will not turn you into a great therapist. It will simply augment someone who's already very good at what they're doing and allow them to do things that they can't ordinarily do with technology like me treating people in New York.
Right. So, yeah. So I guess my perspective is that, you know, as you said earlier, that you know, clinicians think that, you know, there's a system and a manual, and we just kind of follow that system, or that the VR is something that gets in the way of the clinical relationship. And yeah. I think both those things, I agree, are wrong. And I think that VR supplements and speeds up the therapeutic process, especially when you're dealing with phobias and anxiety.
That's right.
A tool to enhance exposure therapy. And I think that you have to think outside the box. So, for example, I have people who, you know, I might go through the standard platform of let's say, Amelia or any other platform that has, let's say, a road. And I have the patient on a highway and they're getting used to the highway. And yep. then eventually I kind of, you know, they get, you know, attenuated to that highway. And that doesn't really raise any anxiety. And so no. I then use, I might use an Oculus Quest and put them in a virtual environment that is specific to the highway that they have trouble with. So, you know, here, you know, I'm on Long Island and somebody or a variety of people have actually videotaped in 360, you know, degree, the entire length of the Long Island Expressway.
Right.
And the Long Island Expressway is a horror show. And most people have difficulty with it if they're going to have a problem with the highway. So I put people on a specific portion of the LIE, you know, because I've had people that didn't like exit 39 to 40. And they would have to get off the highway and get back on. And so by putting them in that particular environment with something that's specific to them, I get closer to dealing with their anxiety. But that requires, yeah. you know, thinking outside the box.
So same thing here in Melbourne. We have a number of bridges that take you over a river, a main river that flows through Melbourne out into the bay. And many years ago, that bridge collapsed during its construction, and many Melburnians still think about that bridge. But nonetheless, the bridge is rather symbolic for taking you from the safety from one side of Melbourne to the other side of Melbourne, because it's seen as a chasm, either that or you drive right around. Many years ago, when I was a child, there was actually a punt, a chain punt that you drove your car over and it would go take about 20 minutes and cross that river. Otherwise, you had to drive miles and miles around to get there. Now they've built the bridge. And there's a secondary bridge similar to that. And many people have struggled. So I've done videos, not in 360, of that put into the headset. So it's linear and it's not 360. But nonetheless, you can ask people to let you know when they're starting to experience some apprehension. And then you can stop the video remotely and then say, what are you noticing now?
Mm-hmm.
And by noticing, you are asking them to become self-aware of mm-hmm. either or combined. What are their thoughts? What are their sensations? What are their feeling states? What are their bodily states? And start to work on that. And the beauty, of course, of doing this approach is that you can do umpteen drives across that bridge during right. a session right. and incorporate a combination of habituation, just getting used to doing this, so that the experience the first time is going to be quite different to the 15th time one would hope, if habituation is working. Mm-hmm. Plus, if you can give them any particular skills of,
right,
of cognitive restructuring, what to say to yourself about this, what to notice about your sensations, and so forth, that gives them a sense of efficacy, of that I can actually do this now. That can set people. So there are specifics. Of course, your hope always is when you do this work is that it will generalize to new or novel situations where they've not experienced this before, where they might historically have been caught by surprise. Oh, my God, here we go again. But this time they say, aha, I know what this is. This is similar to what I experienced there. It's new, it's novel, but I'm having the same sensations. I can apply the same self-management techniques to this novel situation. I think that's where we want to get to. And VR is a very nice conduit or tool to help us get there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I have lots of people come in and they say, well, I have difficulty on a plane.
Yeah.
You have to figure out what is the source of that difficulty. Is it claustrophobic? I have people who have difficulty with the noise. I have people who have difficulty with that sense of not being in control. And then when you talk to them long enough, you know, you say, well, how about this environment? It has nothing to do with planes. They go, oh yeah, I'm not good there either.
Yeah,
and they start to say, you know, you start to find out that it's not just one thing that they have difficulty with. It's a bunch of little things. So it's already generalized. And so you're right. If you learn the skill sets to kind of conquer one, it does generalize because you've learned, oh, I have the skills to do this and I can use it here, here, and here. So it does, once you conquer one, that's what I tell people, let's hit the one that you have the most difficulty with. We conquer that one, the rest of them will fall into place.
That's certainly the hope. And that's, I think, the new way of thinking about exposure way, the exposure methods of working, is to try and optimize those techniques. Because as you and I both know, and most psychologists who are au fait with the current literature, it still represents the gold standard of treatment, exposure work. Mm-hmm. However, most psychologists do not employ it. And one of the troubles is that we have too many dropouts, people who can't sustain the exposure. And I don't say it's their fault. I put it down to the psychologist not doing their job properly between you and me.
I also think that the old way of doing it, the non-VR way of doing it, created problems because, you know, it's very difficult to have somebody who they're sitting in your office and you're saying, okay, I want you to imagine that you're in this particular stressful situation that you have trouble with. Hold on to that image, you know, use your imagination. Why would anyone really want to do that? So they can't hold on to the image long enough and it becomes uncomfortable. But with VR,
I think what happens is that you actually can help them reinforce their escape strategies because they can just switch it off and go and lie on the beach where you are. Yeah. And just take it easy and escape. So we have to be very careful that in using that we are able to help our patients stay long enough within that scary environment to experience some form of habituation.
Right.
Thus some inhibitory mechanisms. But I think because we don't have access to their imagination, we don't know how real it feels. We can try and measure by looking at things like heart rate or heart rate variability or skin conductance, and we can get some kind of analog measure of, well, they seem to be quite aroused, but we really don't know what it's in what it's content with, you know, what's the source of this arousal.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, the remote way of doing this eliminates, for me anyway, heart rate variability and Givonic skin response. I can't measure that. And so I have to rely on subjective unit of distress scales, but I also rely on watching them. And so, it's very important for me to do my work where I can visually see them. And even when they're wearing the virtual reality headsets, because I could watch their body posture and I could look at their breathing and I could see what's going on. And most people are kind of, I hate to use the word ignorant, but unaware of what their bodies are doing when they get stressed. So I know, like, you know, in the airlines, you know, you don't want them grabbing the seats and clenching. And what I find mostly is, besides the breathing problem, is that their shoulders tend to go up and they tend to hunch a little. And there's got to be this feedback system between you know, the posture of the body and the brain, one telling the other, we're in trouble. And so I think when those shoulders go up and the posture is that tense, then that just sends a signal to the brain, okay, you know, we're in trouble. You need to protect us now.
Yes, you need to accelerate your mechanisms for dealing with threat. Mm-hmm. Even though on an intellectual level, the patient will often tell us, I know I'm not in danger. And it's an intellectual appreciation of the safe environment that they're in, and yet, but their bodies are deceiving them into believing and acting as if they're still in danger, falling out of a tree or falling over a cliff or whatever it might be, that has been an inherent part of mammalian survival all sure. over 100,000 years.
Sure.
So
sure.
I think our task is to help people understand these mechanisms. So I'd say that most of the good work that's being done in this environment spends a considerable amount of time exploring the neuroscience of fear and threat in a very convenient and understandable way using common life examples. Mm-hmm. Rather than overwhelming people with amygdala and, you know, and this right. chordate nucleus, whatever else. But, you know, just to explain that there are these mechanisms at work and using common examples like, you know, you walk down the street, you've got your face stuck in your iPhone and you don't see that the footpath, your sidewalk has been raised this amount and you trip and automatically your hands go forward to protect your face.
Mm-hmm.
And so you protect your jaw and your face because you need those to survive. You can get away with breaking your wrists, which is what's going to happen here. But no one taught you how to do that. No one sent you to school. It's just built into us.
Right.
And a lot of the environments that our patients are afraid to be, to go into and stay in have got lots of events which trigger the same kind of self-protective mechanisms. And we've got to give people an understanding of, you know, don't be so hard on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
This is hardwired and built into us and helps us to survive exactly. for 100,000 years.
Right. I always tell people, you know, the back part of the brain is a lot faster than the front part of the brain. And so, you know, the back part of the brain reacts like that. And now you're playing catch up, you know, trying to kind of quell it and quiet it down with the front part of your brain. But the front part of your brain is just, it's slower. And it's the system is already engaged by the time you're trying to reason yourself out of it.
And moreover, by the time that happens, you're thinking capacity will actually be co-opted to support the reasons why you're feeling afraid.
Mm-hmm.
So I no longer use terms like rational and irrational because it's a long way removed from what you and I would have been taught
right.
years ago with rational emotive therapy or rational emotive behavior therapy in the 70s, 80s, 90s, because the terms rational and irrational have been co-opted for general use. You know, people say, oh, you're just being irrational, meaning you're being unwise or neurotic or crazy, when in fact you and I would have started off using the term irrational in a different kind of way than
yeah.
it's being used nowadays. And a part of it is that we have to understand that that thoughts are very powerful, but they often come late to the picture.
Right.
And they occur oftentimes when our bodies are already in a state of very heightened vigilance, and basically we get confirmation bias. We basically become very selective with our thinking to support what I'm feeling.
Right. Well, that's the rationalization for it, you know.
That's right.
I'm trying to make sense of why
right.
my body is doing this and why I feel this way. And therefore, yeah. if I'm feeling this way, it must mean that there is danger here.
That's right. And so part of our task is to test out, is it really dangerous? What experiments can we do? And VR is so neat for conducting experiments because the frontal lobe part, the intellectual executive function part, knows I'm sitting in Howard's office or I'm sitting
right.
in my own home. So it can't be real, but my threat response system centered around my limbic system is saying, hold on, sounds like a plane, looks like a plane. If you can get them to do some coffee smells or some kerosene smells, paraffin, smells like a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got a system like mine where my seats move a little bit and there's vibration, moves like a plane, bang, it's a plane.
Right.
In other words, that limbic system joins up the dots very quickly, even though it could be incorrect, but it joins up very quickly because better to be safe than sorry is what's kept us alive all these years confronting danger.
Right. You know, I'm not great with heights personally.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When the representative from SIOS came over to demo the system. He put me in all of the virtual environments, and I just kind of sat there and went, "Ah, doesn't mean anything to me." You know, I thought maybe this wasn't really, you know, I wasn't ready for prime time. And then he said, "Okay, let me just put you in one last one." So he put me on the edge of the building where you walk out to a balcony.
Yep.
And I'm in my office. I knew exactly where it was. And he said, "Okay, just take a step." And I said, "No, I don't think so." My body wouldn't let me take the step, even though I knew cognitively where I was. And I went, "All right, I get it."
It's one of the VR low-hanging fruits to do a demonstration for disbelieving psychologists. Mm-hmm. And I've done this on several occasions. And the really low-hanging fruit, of course, is roller coasters, which makes anyone sick. But the next one is to use something in the Oculus Quest like Richie's Plank, which is an app that was developed here in Australia, in Brisbane. And mm-hmm. And ask people to walk out there. I actually have a physical plank in the therapy room.
Right. Yeah.
And people can see that there's a plank there. They can actually walk on and
feel it.
The plank is actually moving a little bit under their feet, and have them walk out and then turn around. You can see them very like you were saying, you watch their faces. Well, I'm watching their legs.
Yeah.
And they're moving very, very gingerly. And can I tell you a funny story? Let me tell you a funny story. About 2 years ago, a colleague of mine who taught me HRV, heart rate variability, early on, Richard Gewurz from Alliance in San Diego. Do you know Richard at all?
No.
No. Okay. Clinical psychologist at Alliance, used to be UCSD, I think it was. And he's got a very close relationship to the people at Thought Technology who makes some superior, biofeedback equipment in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys who is a superior teacher and tech support person, Frank DeGregorio, came out and they did a whole section on, they just released a new device which sat on your finger. Here, let me show it to you. I do happen to have one with me. Bear with me while I open it up. Oh, I put it down here. I can't see it right now. Oh, here it is. Found it. So it's this sort of device.
Yeah. Right.
Goes finger.
Yeah.
And you can see here, you've got some pads there. So it measures GSR. It measures HR and HRV.
Wow.
And it will also measure respiration because it's got an accelerometer. So you have people put their hand on their tummy, on their abdomen, and you get a respiration move as well.
Wow. Okay. That's great.
And skin temperature for long range. So it's got sensors built in, not cheap. Anyway, they were demonstrating this new equipment. And Frank was doing the big demonstration showing how it all worked. And I said, and I brought my question after lunch, and I said, "Do you want to have a try at this, Frank, and just see, are you afraid of heights?" He said, "No, I'm terrific with heights." And there's about a dozen of us in the hotel room, and so I hooked him up, and he had the software working, put the headset on him, walked him into the elevator. He said, "This is interesting. Oh, good effect." And the elevator opens up, bang, and he starts to do two walks, and we're all watching the GSR going bang.
Right.
And we're killing ourselves laughing. And he says, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "Do you want to know? You want to know what your GSR is doing? What your heart rate's doing? Take another couple of steps, Frank." And he just paused and he froze.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very revealing to not just him, but to Richard and to the group who was in attendance that this device could cause such a strong reaction. And it was visible. He said, "Take the headset up and watch. Look at your GSR," and it was still going up.
Yeah.
So, and I think it's very important that when we ask people for their SUDs, their subjective units, we must understand it's subjective and it is colored by expectations. Oh, should I be having a high distress here? What will my therapist think of me if I don't or if I do? As compared to an objective measure, which is repeatable without all the other stuff. So I think the what we're looking for is some way to have people's SUDs match the objective measure so people can rely. If I feel this, this is what's likely to happen. I think that the model for this, if I'm going to hold it, can you see my little dot there?
Yeah. I see.
So that's a glucose measuring device.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The difficulty with glucose sometimes is you can become very sensitive when it falls too low because you get woozy and dizzy. But like blood pressure, you're insensitive to when it goes up. And that's the more dangerous part. I mean, there's danger in having go low if you're driving. You don't want to black out when you're driving. But in terms of treatment, you want to be careful to keep your sugars below a certain level. Otherwise, right. You get long-term damage. As time goes on and you do frequent measures and you compare your subjective experience with the objective measure, you get better and better at being able to look inside yourself at your subjective measure and be accurate. And I think that's what we want to do with the HIV and the skin conductance and SUDS for anxiety. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. It's just the problem, until they come up with a real good system that is remote operated and feedback is given to us, I think I'm still stuck at this point with subjective unit of distress scores. And I agree. I've had people in the past who would say, I'm fine. But you know what? They were clearly not fine. Or I've had people say, well, you know what? A couple of people who would say, I'm fine, but I can't see anymore. And I'd say, well, what do you mean you can't see anymore? And they would take off the headset and it's completely fogged over.
Right. All right. So let's ask ourselves, where are we going? I mean, if we were to do a session two here, and the session two was to be about the future of VR in the next 2 years, what excites you? What are you cautious? How is COVID going to play into all of this? Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts?
I'm super cautious about loss of confidentiality. I don't like the idea that, for example, Oculus, which is a better platform than say, a standard 3 degree of freedom headset. But I don't like the idea that Facebook owns it, and they might take that information in a way that I don't want them to use it. I know they have enterprise versions of that headset, but they're too costly, I think, at this point. So that's one of my concerns. The other concern I have is, and as we talked about earlier, people who don't know what they're doing, entering the field and being careless about handling patients and potentially re-traumatizing them or causing harm in such a way that, it's at a distance, it's just more difficult to control. It's so much easier when someone's in your office and you can see if they're starting to get, a little stressed, and how do I calm them down? How do I kind of like pull them back? Yeah. I can't do that as easily if they're, 1,000 miles away.
And our colleagues who practice from a psychoanalytic perspective are also somewhat aghast at the idea that coming to your office, which for our patients may be one of the few safe places in the world where they can just sit and talk about what they're experiencing without fear of being judged, without fear of someone else listening in. The promise of confidentiality is supreme there as compared to over a network or at home where someone can listen in. I mean, I don't know about you, but about a third of my male patients, I see them in their cars.
Yeah, I do a lot of car therapy. All right, Les.
Okay, enjoy, and we'll speak again soon. Take care.
Okay, all right, take it easy. Bye. Well, that's today's show. The end was a little odd because we were just having a conversation, and I just kind of stopped at that point. So if you want to learn more about Les Postman and his practice, you can go to his website, which is flightwise.com.au. That's flightwise, flightwise.com.au. Until next time, this is Dr. Gert for the Shrink Is It.